The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann. Before we get going, I want you to know that this week's show is sponsored by Squarespace, which is great news for you. Because if you want to build a website and you're not sure where to begin, Squarespace is simple and clean and super easy to use. And there's a free trial. To start yours, visit squarespace.com/guardian. And now, on with the show. On this week's Tech Weekly, anticipating the future. It can be a tricksy thing. For every person who's accurately predicted smartwatches or autopiloted planes, there are many who claimed we'd now be living in underwater colonies eating only algae tablets. Well, Alec Ross, previously senior advisor for innovation to Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, has made a bookload of predictions in his new book, The Industries of the Future. From robotics to big data to the weaponization of code, it's essentially his best guess at a roadmap for the future and how tech is set to shape our children's lives. So, what's going to be in their lives? Let's find out. I predict an illuminating discussion ahead. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Alec Ross spent 4 years travelling the world for Hillary Clinton, advising her on issues including cybersecurity, internet freedom, disaster response, and the use of network technologies in conflict zones. He now serves as an advisor to investors and corporations and other government leaders to help them understand how disruptive network technologies are affecting geopolitics and markets. His new book, The Industries of the Future, looks at the sort of changes that are going to emerge in the next 20 years and how we can navigate them, from the commercialization of genomics to the impact of technology on our money. And Alec joins me now. Alec, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Now, you were senior advisor for innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. That sounds like a very impressive job, but also a slightly made up one. How did you get to do that? Did you create your own role?
It was entirely made up. I made up my own title. I made up my own job. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I helped beat her. In the 2007-2008 election, in my own modest way, running tech and media policy for the Obama campaign. And so she then recruited me to come work for her. She was like, hey, buddy, I thought I was going to be president. And, you know, I had all these people who were going to fill up the federal government. Now I need to get them all into one place, the State Department. But I need to make one exception. I need one of you internet people.
And of course, with the job that she ended up doing, going around the world meeting international leaders, I imagine coming at that from a perspective of innovation was really enlightening. I mean, you were seeing different countries all over the world with completely different geopolitical positions.
It was fascinating. You know, my job was, as you suggest, externally focused. So it wasn't, say, setting up computer servers in basements to do our email. But rather I was on airplanes traveling what I guess had been summed up as the equivalent of two round trips to the moon with a side trip to New Zealand, basically trying to figure out how we could maximize the potential of technology to advance America's foreign policy interests.
And when you went around the world, was there a feeling of, oh, these are the Americans? You know, that's where Silicon Valley is. That's where the future is coming from. Or did you actually visit some countries in the world? I'm thinking of Korea here, for example, where I actually went there and got the sense they were way ahead of what you were doing.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think, first of all, people around the world, even when they don't like America, they tend to respect our technology. You know, Google and Facebook and this one and that one tend to have a resonance that's sort of like the Beatles and Blue Jeans were, you know, for the UK and the USA back during the Cold War. Now, I do think that that's diminished a little bit over the last couple of years. But when I was doing this job, 2009 to 2013, there was always an enormous amount of respect for it. And in places that were very highly developed, like Korea, as you mentioned, I think that similarly there, though they had Samsung to our Apple, there was an enormous amount of curiosity and interest and openness.
And how much of that is because, and not to downplay, obviously what's coming out of Silicon Valley is absolutely cutting edge, but how much of it is to do with the marketing and the branding of the American companies, and how much is to do with their actual strength in the market, do you think?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think that to the extent that these companies have really strong brands, it's rooted first and foremost in the fact that it's a product that people use and love. You know, I don't think Google, for example, has ever had much of an advertising budget. Apple certainly has. You know, they have a very famous, sort of well-crafted brand. But I think ultimately, if their products were crap, then it wouldn't matter at all what the advertisements were. And I think that for the most part, the brands of consumer-facing technology companies are more a product of the quality of the technology than the quality of their advertising company.
And your book, The Industries of the Future, is more of a conceptual book rather than about consumer technology. But just whilst we're on this subject, it does mention your trips to see people working for Alibaba in China. It does mention your trips to Africa, where you see them founding new mobile phone technologies. Is there a company that we here in Britain are completely unaware of who are going to dominate the future, in your view, that we should be aware of?
Oh, goodness gracious. That's a great question. I mean, what I would say is I think that there are big data companies that right now probably have 20, 30, 40 employees that in 5 years will have 20,000 employees. And I think, honestly, they could very easily come, by the way, from the United Kingdom. I think a lot of what's happening in Cambridge right now, for example, is as good as anything that's happening around the globe. So I don't know that I could pinpoint a company that's going to be the next big platform, the next Amazon, Facebook, Google, or the like. But I do think that there are industries where there are young companies that will be enormous in the next 4, 5, 6 years.
Okay, so let's talk about the book and the concepts that you do bring up in the book, which is kind of a future-gazing idea. You're saying, what are going to be the next big industries that are going to dominate tech? And you start with perhaps the sexiest subject, robots. Although, I must say, not a very sexy example of robots, robot carers for elderly people.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think the robots of the cartoons and movies of the 1970s are going to be the reality of the 2020s. And I think the combination of modeling belief space, the mathematical breakthroughs that have allowed robots to go from being more two-dimensional to more three-dimensional, combined with cloud robotics, which basically mean that the robots themselves can be relatively low-cost, low-weight devices, as opposed to packed with hundreds of thousands of dollars of hardware and software, are going to really create almost hockey stick growth like in the AI and robotics fields.
So in simple terms, a robot would be like an iPhone. You can wipe it and then you can download your profile onto it. You can go and visit your friend in the country. They've got a robot and it can become your robot. But if I think about the Jetsons and I think about that thing following them around their apartment, it was about a more human connection than that. The idea that you'd be able to wipe Rosie and she'd still be there if you replaced her with Jeff seems odd. The human connection is the thing we have yet to prove, isn't it? Whether people can bond with this thing in their house.
And I think that we're a long way from that. So you brought up the elder care robots being created in Japan. And I think this is a perfect illustration of the questions that are still out there about robotics and about artificial intelligence generally. A lot of these advanced robots are being developed in countries like South Korea and Japan, where they believe in animism. In Shinto, for example, it's practiced by 80% of the people in Japan. They believe that inanimate objects also can have souls. So they believe that the robot built by Honda or Toyota that lifts grandparents out of bed or plays the violin for them can have a soul, can have a being. Whereas in Western cultures, like in the UK or the USA, we tend to see them as soulless objects that need to be feared. Our mythology, from Icarus and his waxed wings to Frankenstein, tells us to actually fear those things which we bring to life, which maybe we ought not. And there's been a lot of good research done on this by, like, Sherry Turkle, for example, from MIT, that really scrutinize whether we should be putting robots and developing AI that substitutes zeros and ones for human emotions and sort of cautions us to take great care in attempting to do so.
And that, in your view, gives the Japanese an edge, because we've got the same problem here, right? We have an elderly population. I mean, we have a different attitude towards immigration. We have people coming to do the jobs of carers that the Japanese don't. But we have the same problem. We could do with carer robots in 50 years' time.
It's strange, but it's true. You know, the Japanese reinvented cars in the 1970s. They reinvented electronics in the 1980s. They could be the real drivers of the robotics of the 2020s, in part because they don't have the cultural baggage that we have in the UK and the USA. But by the same token, I think that money is going to drive a lot of this. Once there's a recognition that there's a future trillion-dollar market in robotics and AI, I have a feeling we'll put our cultural prejudices aside, the venture capital will flow, and the invention and commercialization will begin soon thereafter.
Well, I mean, yes, the business people might put their concerns to one side, but, you know, my grandmother might not want to play bridge with a robot. I'm not sure that's going to change, is it? It's something that's going to take longer to evolve.
I hope not. Bluntly, you know, I don't want my mother to be taken care of by a robot. You know, my book, The Industries of the Future, is neither utopian nor dystopian. You know, most people who write books about the future, it's either, oh, this is great. We're all going to live to be 150 years old, happy, healthy, wealthy, and wise. Or it's written, you know, from the fetal position by somebody with a clenched fist going, you know, I hate Silicon Valley. And I'd like to think that this book is a book of more realistic idealism. And, you know, I look at the developments in robotics like elder care robots, and I think that they will do some interesting and fascinating things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I want them in my home and my parents' home, walking the streets in my community. And so there's a little bit of a wary eye around some of this development.
I sense, though, that it's interesting you use the phrase realistic idealism. I sense that although you position yourself in the middle, you are something of an optimist. You know, okay, you're not an evangelist, but you're someone who looks at the future and says, this is exciting, I want to see it.
I do. It is a net optimistic book. I'm a characteristically mostly optimistic American.
And is that because your job is unlikely to be replaced by a robot anytime soon?
Well, it certainly helps. It certainly helps that I feel hopeful about my economic future. If I were working class, if I had the same economic station that I did growing up, you know, as the book describes, I put myself through university in part by working as a midnight janitor and working on a beer truck. There is no royal blood in this body. But I've had a really good 20 years since, and that is something that is, I feel very fortunate about. And part of why I can be and am optimistic about the future is I know that I'm not as vulnerable as the people that I grew up with in coal country in the United States. And were I of limited skills and still in coal country, then I would be less optimistic.
Right. So those people reading the book, you'd forgive them for getting in the fetal position.
Well, first of all, I hope they actually read the book. And actually, the reason why I wrote The Industries of the Future is that much of the last 10 years of my life has been spent with elites, elites in government, elites in business. And I think it's hugely problematic, actually, that the forces shaping our future are so poorly understood by people in the working classes. And if many of them did read this book, they might curl into the fetal position. Or more productively, if they have kids, they would think about what they can do to intervene in their children's lives to make sure that their kids are prepared for what will be a future that's very different than present day.
Which is what? So you're listening to this and you have a relatively meager income, but you're interested in the future and you want to future-proof your children. What do you do?
Well, first of all, if you have an internet connection, which even people of modest incomes by and large have internet connections, you have access to world-class education. So, for example, my 13-year-old son is taking Mandarin right now, and he's taking Mandarin for free online, and it's really high-quality education. There are free computer programming classes. There are free language learning classes. There are wonderful resources online that if your kids are not getting the right kind of education at school, and if you have limited means, if you read my book and understand what some of the resources are out there, you can direct your kids so that as they grow older, they have some skills that will be durable in a world with more automation.
But one of the things that's automated is language, isn't it, and translation. So again, you know, learning how to speak lots of languages to immunize yourself against a future where computers speak lots of languages doesn't necessarily seem that helpful.
It solves one problem, but it doesn't solve another. So what's interesting is that I do think things like language acquisition will increasingly be done electronically. So I imagine a day where you can put an earbud in your ear And when somebody speaks to you, the language you actually hear in your earbud at the speed of sound, measuring the frequency, wavelength, and sound intensity of the speaker, speaks the language in your ear, in the language that you want to hear. Now, having said that, recognizing that we do live in a 196 country world, and today's frontier countries are going to be tomorrow's developing countries, and today's developing countries are going to be tomorrow's developed countries, the ability to actually speak a native language, to get on a plane, get some good old-fashioned ink stamps in your passport, and be able to do business around the world, I think is going to grow to be an ever more valuable resource.
Good. Well, I'm glad there's still a place for some face-to-face time there as well.
I'd like to think so.
What you're describing there of, you know, a man or a woman walking around with an earpiece in, it made me think you were talking about cloud robotics earlier and how the robots might all be linked to each other and to the computer infrastructure. But of course, if we're walking around with earpieces in and perhaps eyepieces and goodness knows what around our body that is connected to the internet, we almost become cloud robots, don't we? We're sort of the Terminator then.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, we're halfway there already. I mean, how tethered are we to today's smartphone? You know, we're pretty tethered to it. If you look at people on the street, how many people have their heads down and their eyes on their smartphone, you know, producing and emitting data, being told which way to walk on the street, getting...
I literally just walked into a pillar on the way into the building, actually, whilst trying to follow a sat-nav.
Well, there you go. There you go. You're the demonstration of this. So I think it's just a progression of an existing trend towards our lives growing more and more digital.
So, okay, so we become increasingly bionic. That kind of moves me towards another theme in your book, which is about genome. Talk us through that, because at the moment, people have a vague understanding that, of course, medicine is moving in this direction. But you say in the book, it's an equivalent stage of the evolution of that technology to when Amazon was founded in 1994 and what we have now in the consumer world.
That's right. The world's last trillion-dollar industry was created out of computer code. The world's next trillion-dollar industry is going to be created out of genetic code. We're now about 15 years past the mapping of the human genome. When we did that, it cost $2.7 billion. To do that today costs about $2,000. What that means is that the 25,000 genes each of us have in our bodies, we're able to draw more information out of those 25,000 genes than we ever have before. And what I think that's going to mean, practically speaking, and this is one of the book's more optimistic sections, is that our children are going to grow up with life expectancies that are probably several years longer than what is presently projected. And that's because we're going to be able to, by looking at our genetic material, be able to diagnose illnesses like cancer far, far, far earlier than we otherwise might, and when it is therefore much more curable. And we'll be able to develop precision medicines. And, you know, I think it's notable that in his final State of the Union address, Barack Obama basically said the thing he wanted to most concentrate the eighth year of his presidency on was the creation of medicines that are rooted in genetics, so that instead of just going to your doctor and getting a drug, sort of a generically constructed drug, one dosage if you're heavy, one dosage if you're skinny, in the future, pharmaceuticals being developed to map to the specific genetic architecture of our body and its illnesses.
And you credit in the book Obama for investing a few $100 million in genetic architecture, but actually that's a drop in the ocean, isn't it, if this is going to be the next big technology that's keeping us all alive. Do you worry about who it is that's going to be controlling that industry?
I do. Because first of all, I think ultimately private capital is going to drive it. And their goals and objectives are principally rooted in profit and loss. And so I do, and I also think that the development of these medications are going to benefit the wealthy before the middle class. So these innovations, it's going to take some time before the National Health Service or American health insurance companies begin to pay for what are today very expensive medical interventions.
And I worry as well about the bedside manner of not only robots, as we were talking about earlier, but kind of home tests and all this kind of technology. I mean, on the one hand, it's fantastic that I could theoretically spit in a tube and it would tell me if I got breast cancer. On the other hand, I haven't got a physician there telling me you've got breast cancer. I'm looking at it on a, you know, like a pregnancy test.
So the best examples of this are those that blend the two. So one example, a company that I describe in the company, which was born out of Stanford University, is called HealthBase. And what they do is you give up your genetic material, but rather than the consumer getting sort of unedited, difficult to interpret content in its raw form, the only person who actually gets access to the data is the doctor. And the doctor then plays the role of basically of translator of that data, of that information to the patient. Because patients with sort of raw genetic information oftentimes don't know the appropriate way to react or what to do.
And that is a problem, isn't it, with a lot of the emerging companies in this field already. People can send off for their information kind of as a gimmick and perhaps get the response back, you're going to get Parkinson's.
And wait until this comes to designer babies. So what's fascinating is we are newly at the point where in the first trimester of a pregnancy, instead of just being able to learn, you know, whether a child to be is a boy or a girl, by taking the genetic material of the embryo, we can now say, congratulations, it's a boy. He'll be between 5'6" and 5'8". He'll have curly brown hair. He'll have a 13% chance of getting Parkinson's. He'll have an 11% chance of being an alcoholic. He'll have an 8% chance of this, that, or everything else. And so what's going to be interesting to me is to see the degree to which people want to be able to get that genetic information. And with that information, what do they do?
And deeply controversial, of course, in your home country, where there's already a lot of debate about, for example, people testing for Down syndrome at the moment.
No, that's right. When my wife was pregnant with each of our three children, we each got the genetic test, which tested the degree to which the child was or was not likely to have Down syndrome. And the idea, of course, is that if there's a very high likelihood, parents have the choice of whether to terminate the pregnancy or not. Now imagine, instead of just testing for Down syndrome, you're testing for literally 150 different things. The probability of which is never 0% across these 150 things. Add to this then the development of CRISPR technology, where we actually might be able to make interventions into the genetic material of a baby-to-be. And we're really entering the realm of science fiction. But science fiction that is actually accessible within the next 5 years.
Okay, and if those children do make it into this world, what are they going to be eating? I want to touch on this because you talk about lab-grown meat in the book. It's something that we see a lot. You know, there was a competition, wasn't there, to try and create something that tasted a bit like a burger out of a bunch of cells in a lab. Is it realistic that you and I are going to be eating that when we go to McDonald's in 20 years' time?
Well, I really like beef. So look, I mean, there are companies now like Impossible Foods and others that are doing lab-grown beef. And it's very, very, very niche right now and very, very, very early. I think that, you know, the prospect of this is something that is decades and decades away. Well, maybe not decades and decades away, a decade away. What actually might accelerate even faster is xenotransplantation. The idea that we could develop organs in pigs, for example, that could then be harvested for human transplantation. So there's a company called Synthetic Genomics, which is developing, for example, lungs that can be grown in pigs and can then be available for transplant into humans that need new lungs. And the plan next is for kidneys and livers. And so I actually think that before we get to the point of eating synthetic meat, what we actually might be doing is getting transplanted organs that are real, but which were grown in pigs as opposed to humans, exclusively for the purpose of transplantation.
If you run a mobile business, you need a payment solution that's simple, safe, and seamless. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more across any platform. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts, it's the full-stack payment solution for your business. To learn more and for your first £30,000 of transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
Some of this future-gazing stuff sounds incredible, and some of it sounds entirely realistic because you always root it in developments that are actually happening now. As you just mentioned, there's a company working on this now. When you look back at people who have future gazed in the past, you look back at some of the writings from the 60s, and some of it was incredibly prescient and some of it now seems ridiculous, like we'd all be living under a dome. Do you think in 10 or 20 years there are some things in your book you've taken a punt on, you've taken a risk on, you are prepared to be proven wrong on?
Well, look, I think the book is sufficiently ambitious that if I'm not wrong about something, then I will have been insufficiently aggressive intellectually. I have no doubt that I will be right about some things and I'll be wrong about some things. But the simple fact of the matter is that because the ink just went on paper, I believe it all now. So right now, I would sort of litigate the likelihood of all of these things happening. But the likelihood of all of these things happening within the next 10 to 15 years, certainly something won't happen.
And I just want to ask you finally about something you say about gender, which I find fascinating, because this seems to me something that perhaps is you wanting your own politics to come true rather than necessarily being an absolutely robust prediction. You say, and I quote, "Innovative companies will continue to steer clear of countries with regressive policies on gender." Now, is that really true? You talk in the book about all of Africa being a massive burgeoning market to rival China and Brazil when we were kids. I mean, their attitudes towards women in some of those African countries are not particularly progressive.
And in some of those African countries, they are. So I've come to believe, what's interesting is all this travel around the world has made me a feminist. And I've come to believe with a lot of conviction that those states and societies that do the most to systematically advantage the role of women in business and society are going to be those that compete and succeed most effectively in the industries of the future. 2 weeks ago, there was actually a center-right think tank called the Peterson Institute, for Economics, which published a study, which I think is enormously important, of more than 2,100 companies that actually shows a correlation between women in the executive ranks and profit and loss. And so I do think that what we need is more data here, but what I've come to believe is that those states and societies, as we move from an industrial-based economy into an increasingly knowledge-based economy, those that create the most open environments for women, for minorities of all types, will be those that create the hubs for imagination, innovation, commercialization, and therefore wealth creation.
And how does this positive view of women and their role in emerging technologies and successful economies tally with Silicon Valley, which is notoriously male-dominated?
You know, this is a case where I'm looking where I have both eyes on the future. I don't think that the last 20 years of the history of the internet and wealth creation in Silicon Valley ought to be a guide for how we tackle the industries of artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics, big data, and other such fields. And I actually think that those companies, those specific companies in Silicon Valley that, in my opinion, have actually done the best advantaging women in their workplace actually stand out among their peers. I look at Facebook and I look at Google, and those two actually do quite well, not just at the senior most ranks, but also in the middle ranks. And I think that, maybe Silicon Valley can look at its peers and learn from them, but also look around the world and see who's doing a better job than they are. And if they make the necessary pivots, maybe Silicon Valley will have another good 20 years.
But you talked about poor people being left out, working class jobs being left out. That's going to include working class women, isn't it?
It certainly will. These things, there are 196 countries on planet Earth. Some states and societies will do better than others, but within some of those countries, like the United States, I think will do very well economically. But that doesn't mean that all 320 million Americans are going to do well. It's going to be good for a lot of people, but it's going to be crap for a lot of people. It's a terrible time to be mediocre at your job if you're working a middle class.
God, I feel like you're writing me my.
No, you're very good. You're very good at what you do, Ollie. You're in no danger of being replaced by a robot.
All right. Well, on that positive note, I think I better wrap it up. Alec, thank you so much for coming in. It's been great to meet you, and well done with the book.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that's it for this week. The Industries of the Future by Alec Ross is out now. I've been Ollie Mann. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Ollie with a Y, MANN. The producer, Alana Chance. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you. Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are the Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.